Me, got in the van, no trouble. Grateful to sit down. I used to say to Gail, once I had her in the basement, "Should have gone to the bathroom instead, you dirty little bitch, shouldn't you? I bet you're the type to piss in the street. Filthy, that is. Filthy. Why are you so interested in drugging?" The flow of talk had suddenly dried up. Creed's blank grey and black eyes darted left and right between each of strikes. "You think Dr. Bamborough will be too clever to get herself drugged by the likes of me, do you?"
"Doctors can make mistakes like anyone else," said Strike. "You met Noreen Sturrock on a bus, right?"
Creed considered Strike for several seconds, as though trying to work something out.
"Buses now, is it? How often did Margot Bamborough take a bus?"
"Frequently, I'd imagine," said Strike.
"Would she have taken a can of Coke from a stranger?"
"That's what you offered Noreen, right? And the Coke was full of phenobarbital."
"Yeah. She was almost asleep by the time we came to my stop. I said, 'You've missed yours, darling. Come on, I'll take you to a taxi rank.' Walked her straight off the bus, arm round her. She wasn't a big girl, Noreen. That was one of the easiest."
"Did you adjust dosage for weight?"
There was another slight pause.
"Buses and cans of pop and adjusting drugs for weight. You know what, Cormoran? I think my second guess was right. You're here for little Louise Tucker."
"No," said Strike with a sigh, settling back in his chair. "As it happens, you were spot on first time round. I was hired by Margot Bamborough's daughter."
There was a longer silence now, and the psychiatrist again checked his watch. Strike knew that his time was nearly up, and he thought Creed knew it too.
"I want to go back to Belmarsh, Cormoran," said Creed,
leaning in now that Strike had leaned back. "I want to finish my book."
"I'm sane. You know it too. You just said it. I'm not ill. It's costing the taxpayer 5 times as much to keep me in here as it would in jail. Where would the British public say I should be, eh?"
"Oh, they want you back in prison," said Strike.
"Well, I agree with them," said Creed. "I agree."
He looked sideways at Dr. Bijral, who had the look of a man about to call a halt.
"I'm sane, and if I'm treated like it, I'll act like it," said Creed.
He leaned further forwards.
"I killed Louise Tucker," said Creed in a soft voice,
and in Strike's peripheral vision, the psychiatrist and the nurse both froze, astonished.
"Picked her up off a street corner in my van, November 1972. Freezing cold that night. She wanted to go home and she had no money. I couldn't resist, Cormoran," said Creed,
those big black pupils boring into Strike's.
"Little girl in her school uniform. No man could resist. Did it on impulse, no planning, no wig, no drug coke, nothing."
"Why wasn't there any trace of her in the basement?" said Strike.
"There was. I had her necklace. But I never had her in the basement, see? You want proof? I'll give you proof. She called her stepmother Claus. Tell Tucker she told me that, all right? Yeah, we had a 5-minute chat about how pissed off she was at home before she realised we were going the wrong way. Then she starts screaming and banging on the windows. I turned into a dark car park," said Creed quietly, "put my hand over her mouth, dragged her into the back of the van, fucked her and throttled her. I'd have liked to keep her longer, but she was loud, too loud. Dumb thing to do, but I couldn't resist, Cormoran. No planning. School uniform. But I had work next day. I needed the van empty. I wanted to take the body back to the basement, but old Vi Cooper was wide awake when I drove back up Liverpool Road. She was looking down at me out the top window when I drove past, so I didn't stop. Told her later she'd imagined it was me. The old bitch used to sit up to see what time I came in. I usually drugged her if I was off on the prowl, but this was a spur-of-the-moment treat."
"What did you do with the body?" said Strike.
"Ah," said Creed, sitting back in his seat. The wet lips slid over each other, and the wide pupils gaped. I think I'm going to need a transfer back to Belmarsh before I tell anyone that. You go and tell the newspapers I've decided to confess to killing Louise, and that I'm sane, and I should be in Belmarsh, and if I'm transferred, I'll tell old Brian Tucker where I put his little girl. You go tell the authorities. That's my offer. You never know. I might even feel up to talking about Margot Bamborough when I'm out of here. Let's get these drugs out of my system, and maybe I'll remember better.
You're full of shit, said Strike, getting to his feet, looking angry. I'm not passing this on.
Don't be like that, because it's not the one you came for, said Creed with a slow smile. You're coming across like a proper narcissist, Cormoran.
I'm ready to go, Strike told Dr. Bijral.
Don't be like that, said Creed. Oi!
Strike turned back.
All right. I'll give you a little clue about where I put Louise's body, and we'll see whether you're as clever as you think you are. All right. We'll see whether you or the police work it out first. If they find the body, they'll know I'm sane, and I'm ready to talk about Margot Bamborough. As long as I get moved where I want to go. And if nobody can figure out the clue, someone will have to come back and talk to me, won't they? Maybe even you. We could play chess for more clues, Cormoran.
Strike could tell that Creed was imagining weeks of front pages as he laid a trail for investigators to follow. Psychological torture for the Tuckers, manipulation of public opinion, Strike, perhaps, at his beck and call. It was a sadist's wet dream.
Go on, then, said Strike, looking down at him. What's the clue?
You'll find Louise Tucker's body where you find M-54, said Creed.
And Strike knew Creed had thought out the clue well ahead of time and was certain that it would have been a clue about Margot, had Strike said he'd been hired by the Tuckers. Creed needed to believe he hadn't given Strike what he really wanted. He had to come out on top.
Right, said Strike. He turned to Dr. Bijral. Shall we?
M-54. All right, Cormoran, called Creed.
I heard you, said Strike.
Sorry not to be able to help with Dr. Bamborough, called Creed.
And Strike could hear his pleasure at the idea that he'd thwarted the detective. Strike turned back one last time, and now he stopped pretending to be angry, and grinned too.
I was here for Louise, you silly fucker. I know you never met Margot Bamborough. She was murdered by a far more skillful killer than you ever were. And just so you know, Strike added, as the nurse's keys jangled and Creed's slack fat face registered dismay, I think you're a fucking lunatic, and if anyone asks me, I'll say you should be in Broadmoor till you rot.
Chapter 69. Bear ye the picture of that lady's head, full lively is the semblant, though the substance dead. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. After almost an hour's debrief with Dr. Bijral, during which the shaken psychiatrist phoned Scotland Yard, the detective left the hospital, feeling as though he'd been there twice as long as he really had. The village of Crowthorne didn't lie on Strike's route back to London, but he was hungry. He wanted to call Robin, and he felt a powerful need to place himself among ordinary people going about their lives, to expel the memory of those empty, echoing corridors, the jangle of keys, and the widely dilated pupils of Dennis Creed. He parked outside a pub, lit himself the cigarette he'd been craving for the past 2.5 hours, then turned his phone back on. He'd already missed 2 calls from Brian Tucker, but instead of phoning the old man back, he pressed Robin's number. She answered on the second ring. What happened? Strike told her. When he'd finished, there was a short silence. Say the clue again, said Robin, who sounded tense.
You'll find her where you find M-54.
Not the M-54, not the motorway. He could have meant that, but he left out the definite article. The M54's 20-odd miles long. I know. Reaction was setting in. Strike should have felt triumphant, but in fact he was tired and tense. His phone beeped at him, and he glanced at the screen. "That's Brian Tucker again, trying to ring me," he told Robin. "What are you going to tell him?" "The truth," said Strike heavily, exhaling smoke out of his open window. "Dr. Bijral's already called Scotland Yard. Trouble is, if that clue's meaningless or unsolvable, it leaves Tucker knowing Creed killed his daughter, but never getting the body back. This could well be Creed's idea of the ultimate torture."
"It's something to have a confession, though, isn't it?" said Robin.
"Tucker has been convinced Creed killed her for decades. Confession without a body just keeps the wound open. Creed'll still have the last laugh, knowing where she is and not telling. How have you got on in the British Library?"
"Oh, fine," said Robin. "I found Joanna Hammond a couple of hours ago."
"And?" said Strike, now alert.
"She had a large mole on her face, left cheek. You can see it in the picture of her wedding in the local paper. I'll text it to you now."
"And the holy—"
"It would have been on the back of her obituary. Same local paper."
"Jesus Christ," said Strike.
There was a longer silence. Strike's phone beeped again, and he saw that Robin had texted him a picture. Opening it, he saw a couple on their 1969 wedding day. A blurry black-and-white picture of a toothy, beaming brunette bride, her hair worn in ringlets, in a high-neck lace dress, a pillbox hat on top of her veil, a large mole on her left cheekbone. The blonde husband loomed over her shoulder, unsmiling. Even minutes into married life, he had the air of a man ready to wield a baseball bat. "She wasn't Sagittarius and a Schmidt," said Robin, and Strike put the phone back up to his ear. "She was Scorpio."
"Which Talbot thought fitted her better because of the mole," said Strike with a sigh. "I should have gone back through all the identifications once you found out about Schmidt. We might have got here sooner."
"What are we going to do about Douthwaite?"
"I'll ring him," said Strike, after a moment's pause. "Now, then I'll call you back."
His stomach rumbled as he called the Allardyce boarding house in Skegness and heard the familiar cross-Scottish accent of Donna, Douthwaite's wife.
"Oh, Christ," she said, when Strike identified himself. "What now?"
"Nothing to worry about," lied Strike, who could hear a radio playing in the background. "Just wanted to double-check a couple of points."
"Steve?"
he heard a yell, away from the receiver.
"It's him! What do you mean? Who? Who do you bloody think?"
Strike heard footsteps, and then Douthwaite, who sounded half angry, half scared.
"What do you want?"
"I want to tell you what I think happened during your last appointment with Margot Bamborough," said Strike.
He spoke for 2 minutes, and Douthwaite didn't interrupt, though Strike knew he was still there because of the distant sounds of the boarding house still reaching him over the line. When Strike had finished his reconstruction of Douthwaite's final consultation, there was silence but for the distant radio, which was playing Blame by Calvin Harris. "So blame it on the night. Don't blame it on me."
"Well," said Strike.
He knew Douthwaite didn't want to confirm it. Douthwaite was a coward, a weak man who ran away from problems. He could have prevented further deaths had he had the courage to tell what he knew. But he'd been scared for his own skin, scared he'd be seen as complicit, stupid, and shabby in the eyes of newspaper readers. And so he'd run. But that had made things worse, and nightmarish consequences had ensued, and he'd run from those too, barely admitting to himself what he feared, distracting himself with drink, with karaoke, with women. And now Strike was presenting him with a dreadful choice that was really no choice at all. Like Violet Cooper, Steve Douthwaite was facing a lifetime of opprobrium from the censorious public, and how much better would it have been if he'd come clean to Talbot 40 years previously, when Margot Bamborough's body could have been found quickly and a killer could have been brought to justice before others had to die.
"Am I right?" Strike said.
"Yes," said Douthwaite at last.
"Okay. Well, if you'll take my advice, you'll go straight to your wife and tell her before the press do it.
There's going to be no hiding from this one.
Shit, said Douthwaite quietly.
See you in court, then, said Strike briskly, and he hung up and called Robin straight back.
He's confirmed it.
Cormoran, said Robin. I advised him to tell Donna.
Cormoran, said Robin again.
What?
I think I know what M54 is.
Nah.
The motorway?
No. M54 is a globular cluster.
A what?
A spherical cluster of stars.
Stars? Said Strike, with a sinking sensation.
Hang on. Listen, said Robin. Creed thought he was being clever, but it only takes a Google search.
They haven't got internet in there, said Strike. He was whining about it.
Well, M54 is a cluster of stars in the constellation Sagittarius, said Robin.
Not astrology again, said Strike, closing his eyes.
Robin, listen to me. He said you'll find her where you find M54, right?
Yeah.
The constellation Sagittarius is also known as the Archer.
So?
Brian showed us the map, Strike. Dennis Creed was a regular visitor to the Archer Hotel in Islington in the early 70s, when he was delivering their dry cleaning. There was a well on the property in the back garden, boarded up and now covered over with a conservatory. A pair of jolly men with matching beer bellies walked into the pub across the road. Strike barely registered them. He'd even forgotten to take drags of the cigarette burning between his fingers.
Think this through, said Robin in his ear. Creed's got a body he didn't expect in the van, but he can't take it to Epping Forest because there was still an active crime scene there. They just found the remains of Vera Kenny. I don't know why he didn't take the body to the basement.
I do, said Strike. He's just told me. He drove past the house and Voy Cooper was awake and at the window.
Okay, right, so he's got to empty the van before work. He knows his way around the Archer Garden and he knows there's a back gate. He's got tools in the back of his van. He could prise those boards up easily.
Cormoran, I'm sure she's in the old Archer well.
There was a brief pause. Then hot ash fell into Strike's lap from his neglected cigarette.
Bollocks!
He flicked the end out of the window, earning himself a look of disapproval from a passing old woman pulling a tartan shopping trolley.
All right, here's what we're going to do, he told Robin. I'll phone Tucker and tell him what's just happened, including your deduction. You call George Laybourne and tell him about the well at the Archer. The quicker the police search it, the better for the Tuckers. Especially if the news leaks that Creed's confessed.
Okay, I'll get onto that right.
Hang on, I haven't finished, said Strike.
He closed his eyes now, and he was rubbing his temples as he thought through everything the agency needed to do, and quickly.
When you've spoken to Laybourne, I want you to ring Barclay and tell him he's going on a job with you tomorrow morning. He can forget Miss Jones's boyfriend for a few hours. Or, most probably all day, if what I think's going to happen happens.
What job are Barclay and I doing?
Asked Robin.
Isn't it obvious? Said Strike,
opening his eyes again.
We're up against the clock if Douthwaite talks to anyone.
So Barclay and I are finding Margot's body, said Strike.
Yes.
There was a long silence. Strike's stomach rumbled again. Now a pair of young women entered the pub, giggling at something one had shown the other on her phone.
You really think she's there?
Said Robin, a little shaken.
I'm sure of it, said Strike.
And you're...
I'm going to call Brian Tucker, eat some chips, make that long-distance phone call. I think they're 3 hours ahead of us, so that should work fine. Then drive back to the office. I'll be back late afternoon, and we can talk it all over properly.
Right, said Robin. Good luck.
She rang off. Strike hesitated for a moment before calling Brian Tucker. He'd have liked to do it with a pint in his hand, but he still needed to drive back to London, and being arrested for drink driving on the eve of catching Margot Bamborough's killer was a complication he really didn't want to risk. Instead, he lit himself a second cigarette and prepared to tell a grieving father that after a 42-year wait, he might soon be in a position to bury his daughter. Chapter 70. And lastly, death. Death with most grim and grisly visage seen. Edmund Spencer,
the Fairy Queen. The morning was so mild it might have been summer, but the leaves of the plane trees beside the telephone box at the mouth of Albemarle Way were starting to turn yellow. A patchwork blue and white sky gave and withdrew warmth as the sun slid in and out behind clouds, and Robin felt shivery in spite of the sweater she was wearing beneath her raincoat, as though a cold wind was blowing up Albemarle Way, the short side street whose tall, unbroken buildings kept it forever in shadow. She was standing beside the telephone box where once, nearly 40 years previously, the killer of Margot Bamborough had waited and watched, feeling, Robin imagined, much as she did now. There must have been fear and nervousness, and doubt that the plan could possibly work, and terror of the consequences of failure. But this sense of kinship didn't make Robin feel any more kindly to the killer. Looking across the road at the ancient arch of St. John's Gate, she could imagine Margot Bamborough walking through it on a rainy evening 40 years previously, or perhaps weaving, feeling strangely groggy and not knowing why. Or had she realized? Possibly. Margot was a clever woman, and that was why she'd had to die. Clerkenwell Road was busy with traffic and pedestrians. Robin felt entirely isolated from all of them. Nobody passing Robin could have the slightest idea of what she was about to try and do, how bizarre they'd think her morning's plans, how macabre. A trickle of panic ran down Robin's spine. Think about something else. There'd been a picture in the metro that morning of Charlotte Ross, wearing sunglasses and a long dark coat, walking along a street in Mayfair with her sister Amelia. There had been no sign of Charlotte's husband or young twins, and the short non-story beneath the picture had told Robin nothing she wanted to know. Charlotte Campbell was spotted enjoying a morning walk in London with her sister, Amelia Crichton, yesterday. Charlotte, who is married to Jago, heir to the Viscountcy of Troy, was recently released from hospital following a prolonged stay in Simmons House, an addiction and mental health facility much favoured by the rich and famous. Charlotte, who once topped Tatler's list of 100 most beautiful Londoners, has been a favourite of the gossip column since she first ran away from school, aged 14. Daughter of, think about something else, Robin told herself, and consciously groped around for another subject. It was September the 20th. A person born today would be born under the sign of Virgo. Robin wondered how long it was going to take to rid herself of the mental tic of tying dates to star signs. She thought of Matthew, who was the Virgoan she knew best. The sign was supposed to be clever and organized and nervous. He was certainly organized and bright in a book-smart way. She remembered Una Kennedy saying, "I sometimes think the cleverer they are with books, the stupider they are with sex," and wondered whether he was now happy about the pregnancy he'd said was accidental. Think about something else. She checked her watch. Where was Barclay? True, Robin had arrived very early, and technically Barclay wasn't late. But she didn't like standing here alone, trying to distract herself from thoughts of what they were about to do. Theo had once stood almost exactly where Robin now was, watching the traffic roll up and down Clerkenwell Road, dark-haired Theo of the coochie earrings and the painful abdomen, waiting for the silver van that would take her away. Why Theo had never come forward afterwards, why she'd never felt enough gratitude to the woman who'd seen her at short notice, at least to rule herself out of suspicion and stop Talbot haring after a delusion, remained a minor mystery. But of course, that assumed that Theo felt grateful. Nobody ever really knew what happened between a doctor and patient. It was the secular equivalent of the confession box. Robin's thoughts had moved to Douthwaite when, at last, she spotted Barclay, who was approaching, carrying a hold all. When he got close enough, Robin heard the tools inside it clinking. "Having a bit of wee déjà vu here," he said, coming to a halt beside her. "Didn't we once go digging for a body before?" "I don't think this qualifies as digging," said Robin. "What's the latest?" "He's gone out," said Robin. "Strike says we've got to wait until he comes back." "What's in there?" asked Barclay, nodding at the carrier bag in Robin's hand.
Chocolate biscuits, said Robin.
Bribe, basically. And has Strike...
Not yet. He's in position. He wants us to... Robin waited for a group of what looked like students to walk out of earshot. Do our bit first. Were you pleased? Robin continued, still trying not to think about what they were about to do until it was absolutely necessary. About the referendum result?
Aye, but don't kid yourself, Owen, said Barclay darkly. This isn't finished. That stupid fucker Cameron's playing right into the Nats' hands. English votes for English laws the day after Scotland decides to stay.
You don't fight fucking nationalism with more fucking nationalism. He wants to get his head out of Farage's arse.
Is this our wee fella now?
Robin looked around. Silhouetted against the end of Albemarle Way was a man walking along with a strange rolling gait, who was carrying two full carrier bags. He stopped at a door, set down his shopping, put his key in the lock, picked up his shopping bags, stepped over the threshold, and vanished from sight.
That's him, said Robin, as her inside seemed to wobble. Let's go.
They walked side by side down the street to the dark blue front door.
He's left the key in the lock, said Barclay, pointing.
Robin was about to ring the bell when the door opened and Sowan Athorne reappeared. Pale, big-eared and mousy-haired, he gaped slightly. He was wearing a Batman sweatshirt. Disconcerted to find two people on his doorstep, he blinked, then addressed Robin's left shoulder.
I left the key.
He reached around to pull it out of the lock. As he made to close the door, Barclay dexterously inserted a foot.
You're Sowan, aren't you?
Said Robin, smiling at him,
while Sowan gaped. We're friends of Cormoran Strike's. You were very helpful to him a few months ago.
I need to put the shopping away, said Sowan.
He tried to close the front door, but Barclay's foot was in the way.
Could we come in? Asked Robin. Just for a little while. We'd like to talk to you and your mum. You were so helpful before, telling Cormoran about your Uncle Tudor.
My Uncle Tudor's dead, said Sowan.
I know, I'm sorry.
He died in the hospital, said Sowan.
Really? Said Robin.
My dad Gwilym died under the bridge, said Sowan.
That's so sad, said Robin.
Could we come in, please, just for a moment? Cormoran wanted me to bring you these, she added, pulling the tin of chocolate biscuits out of her bag. As a thank you.
What's them?
Asked Sowan, looking at the tin out of the corner of his eye.
Chocolate biscuits.
He took the tin out of her hand.
Yeah, you can come in, he said,
and turning his back, he marched up the dark interior stairs. With a glance at Barclay, Robin led the way inside. She heard her companion close the door behind her, and the clinking of the tools in his hold-all. The staircase was steep, narrow and dark after daylight, the light bulb overhead dead. When Robin reached the landing, she saw, through the open door, a white-haired woman with big ears like Sowan's, wiping the surfaces of a brown-tiled kitchen, while Sowan, who had his back to her, eagerly peeled the plastic wrapper off the tin of chocolate biscuits. Deborah turned, her neat white plait sliding over her shoulder, to fix her dark eyes on the two strangers.
"Hello, Mrs. Athorne," said Robin, coming to a halt in the hall. "Are you from the social work department?" asked Deborah slowly. "I phoned Claire."
"We can help with anything Claire can," said Barclay, before Robin could answer. "What's the problem?"
"Him downstairs is a bastard," said Sowan,
who was now digging busily in the tin of chocolate biscuits and selecting the one wrapped in gold foil.
"These are the best ones in the shiny paper. That's how you know."
"Is the man downstairs complaining again?" asked Robin, with a sudden upswell of excitement that bordered on panic.
"Can we have a look at what the problem is?" asked Barclay. "Where does he think his ceiling's cracking?"
Deborah pointed towards the sitting room.
"I'll have a wee look,"
said Barclay confidently, and he set off towards the sitting room.
"Don't eat all of them, Sammy,"
said Deborah, who'd returned to the methodical wiping of the kitchen tiles.
"They gave them to me, you silly woman,"
said Sowan, his mouth full of chocolate. Robin followed, fighting a sense of utter unreality.
Could what Strike suspected really be true? Two budgerigars were twittering in a cage in the corner of the small sitting room, which, like the hall, was carpeted in swirls of brown and orange. A crocheted blanket had been spread over the back of the sofa. Barclay was looking down at the almost completed jigsaw of unicorns leaping over a rainbow. Robin glanced around. The place was sparsely furnished. Apart from the sofa and the budgie's cage, there was only a small armchair, a television set on top of which stood an urn, and a small shelving unit on which sat a few old paperbacks and some cheap ornaments. Her eyes lingered on the Egyptian symbol of eternal life, painted on a patch of dirty green wall. She lies in a holy place. "Floorboards," she murmured to Barclay. He shook his head, looked meaningfully down at the jigsaw of the unicorns, then pointed with his foot at the overlarge ottoman on which it lay.
"Oh, God, no," whispered Robin, before she could stop herself.
"You think?"
"Otherwise the carpet would have had to come up," murmured Barclay. "Move furniture, take up floorboards. And would it make the ceiling crack down below? And what about the smell?"
Samhain now came ambling into the room, eating his second foil-wrapped biscuit.
"Do you want a hot chocolate or not?"
he asked, looking at Robin's knees.
No, thank you," said Robin, smiling at him. "Does he want hot chocolate or not?"
"No thanks, mate," said Barclay. "Can we move this jigsaw? Need to have a look beneath it."
"Deborah don't like her jigsaw touched," said Samhain sternly.
"We need to prove the man downstairs is lying, though," said Robin, "about his ceiling cracking."
"Deborah,"
called Samhain,
"they want to move you a jigsaw."
He walked out of the room with his rocking gait, and his mother took his place at the door, eyeing Robin's shoes as she said,
"You can't move my unicorns."
"We need to have a little look underneath it," said Robin. "I promise we'll take very good care of it and not break it. We could move it." She looked around, but there was no stretch of floor big enough to accommodate it.
"In my bedroom you can put it," said Samhain,
bobbing back into sight.
"On my bed they can put it, Deborah."
"Excellent idea," said Barclay heartily, bending to pick it up.
"Close it up first," said Robin hastily, and she folded the wings of the jigsaw mat over the puzzle, containing all the pieces.
"Good job," said Barclay,
and he carried the jigsaw mat carefully out through the sitting-room door, followed by Deborah, who looked both anxious and alarmed, and by the self-important Samhain, who seemed proud to have had his plan adopted by this new man in the flat. For a few seconds, Robin stood alone in the sitting-room, looking down at the ottoman that was far too big for this small room. It had been covered with a cloth that Robin suspected dated from the 60s, being of thin, faded purple cotton, and carrying the design of a mandala. If a tall woman curled herself up, she might fit inside that ottoman, as long as she was thin, of course.
"I don't want to look," Robin thought suddenly, panic rising again. "I don't want to see."
But she had to look. She had to see. That was what she was there for. Barclay returned, followed by both an interested-looking Samhain and a troubled Deborah.
"That doesn't open," said Deborah, pointing at the exposed ottoman. "You can't open that. You leave that alone."
"I had my toys in there," said Samhain. "Didn't I, Deborah? Once I did. But my dad Gwillem didn't want me to keep them there no more."
"You can't open that,"
repeated Deborah, now distressed.
"Leave it. Don't touch that."
"Deborah," said Robin quietly, walking towards the older woman, "we've got to find out why the ceiling downstairs is cracking. You know how the man downstairs is always complaining and saying he'd like you and Samhain to move out."
"I don't want to go,"
said Deborah at once, and for a split second her dark eyes almost met Robin's before darting back to the swirly carpet.
"I don't want to move. I'm going to ring Claire."
"No,"
said Robin, moving quickly around Deborah and blocking her way back to the kitchen with its old wall-mounted phone beside the fridge. She hoped Deborah hadn't heard her panic.
"We're here instead of Claire, you see, to help you with the man downstairs. But we think, Sam and I..."
"My dad Gwillem called me Sam," said Samhain. "Didn't he, Deborah?"
"That's nice," said Robin, and she pointed at Barclay. This man's called Sam, too.
Is his name Sam, is it?
Said Samson gleefully, and boldly he raised his eyes to Barclay's face, before looking away again, grinning.
Two Sams, Deborah, two Sams!
Robin addressed the perplexed Deborah, who was now shifting from foot to foot, in a manner reminiscent of her son's rolling walk. Sam and I want to sort this out, Deborah, so you don't have any more trouble with the man downstairs.
Guillaume didn't want that opened,
said Deborah, reaching nervously for the end of her white plait.
He didn't want that opened. He wanted that kept shut.
Guillaume would want you and Samson to be allowed to stay here, though, wouldn't he? Deborah put the end of her plait in her mouth and sucked at it, as though it was an ice lolly. Her dark eyes wandered as though in search of help.
I think, said Robin gently, it would be good if you and Samson wait in his bedroom while we have a look at the ottoman. Naughty man, said Samson,
and he cackled again.
Sam! Hey, Sam! Naughty man!
Good one,
said Barclay, grinning. Come on, said Robin, sliding an arm around Deborah. You wait in the bedroom with Samson. You haven't done anything wrong, we know that. Everything's going to be fine. As she led Deborah slowly across the landing, she heard Samson say cheerily,
I'm staying here, though.
No, mate,
Barclay replied, as Robin and Deborah entered Samson's tiny bedroom. Every inch of wall was covered in pictures of superheroes and gaming characters. Deborah's gigantic jigsaw took up most of the bed. The floor around the PlayStation was littered with chocolate wrappers.
Look after your mom, and after I'll teach you a magic trick,
Barclay was saying.
My dad Guillaume could do magic. Aye, I know, I heard. That make it easy for you to do magic, if your dad could do it, eh?
We won't be long, Robin told Samson's frightened mother. Just stay in here for now, all right? Please, Deborah. Deborah simply blinked at her. Robin was particularly afraid of the woman trying to reach the phone on the kitchen wall because she didn't want to have to physically restrain her. Returning to the sitting room, she found Barclay still bargaining with Samson.
Do it now,
Samson was saying, grinning, looking from Barclay's hands to his chin to his ear.
Go on, show me now.
Sam can only do magic after we've done our job, said Robin. Samson, will you wait in the bedroom with your mum, please?
Go on, mate, said Barclay. Just for a bit, then I'll teach you the trick.
The smile faded off Samson's face.
Silly woman, he said sulkily to Robin. Stupid woman.
He walked out of the room, but instead of going into his bedroom, he made for the kitchen.
Shit,
Robin muttered. Don't do anything yet, Sam. Samson reappeared, holding the tin of chocolate biscuits, walked into his bedroom, and slammed the door behind him.
Now, said Robin. Stay by the door, said Sam. Keep an eye on them.
Robin closed the sitting room door, leaving a tiny crack through which he could spy on Samson's bedroom, and gave Barclay the thumbs up. He pulled the mandala covering off the ottoman, bent down, gripped the edge of the lid, and heaved. The lid wouldn't budge. He put all his strength into it, but still it didn't shift. From Samson's room came the sound of raised voices. Deborah was telling Samson not to eat any more chocolate biscuits.
It's like it's locked on the inside, said Barclay, panting and letting go.
He unzipped his holdall, and after some rummaging, pulled out a crowbar, which he wedged the end of into the crack separating the lid from the body of the ottoman.
Come on, you fucker,
he gasped, as the end of the crowbar lost its grip and nearly hit Barclay in the face.
Something's sticking it down.
Robin peeked back at Samson's bedroom door. It remained closed. Mother and son were still arguing about the chocolate biscuits. The budgerigars chirruped. Beyond the window, Robin could see an aeroplane trail, a fuzzy white pipe cleaner stretched across the sky. Everyday things became so strange when you were waiting for something dreadful to happen. Her heart was pounding fast.
Help me,
said Barclay, through gritted teeth. He'd managed to get the end of the crowbar deeper into the crack in the ottoman.
It's gonna take two.
After another glance at Samson's closed door, Robin hurried over to Barclay and gripped the crowbar alongside him. Using all their weight and force, both pushed the handle towards the floor.
Jesus, panted Robin. What's holding it?
Where's strike when you need?
There was a loud, crunching, cracking noise. The crowbar suddenly gave way as the lid of the ottoman opened. Robin turned and saw a cloud of dust rising into the air. Barclay pushed the lid up. The ottoman had been filled with concrete, which had stuck the lid down upon itself. The grey matter was lumpy and looked as though it might have been badly mixed. In two places, something smooth broke through the uneven, ashen surface, one resembling a few inches of walrus tusk, the other a curved surface that hinted at a dark ivory globe. Then Robin saw, stuck to a bit of the concrete that had adhered to the lid of the ottoman, a few fair hairs. They heard footsteps on the landing. Barclay slammed the lid of the ottoman down as Samhain opened the door. He was followed by Deborah.
"I'll teach you that magic trick now," said Barclay, walking towards Samhain. "Come in the kitchen. We'll do it there."
The two men left. Deborah shuffled into the room and picked up the faded purple throw that Robin had cast aside.
"Did you open it?"
she mumbled, eyes on the old carpet. "Yes," said Robin, far more calmly than she felt. She sat down on the ottoman, even though she felt sacrilegious doing it.
"I'm sorry, Margot. I'm so sorry."
"I need to make a phone call now, Deborah. Then I think we should all have some hot chocolate."
Chapter 71. Such is the face of falsehood, such the sight of foul Duessa, when her borrowed light is laid away, and counterfeasance known. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen.
A train came roaring and rattling along the southeastern railway line. Strike, who was standing on the opposite side of the road, felt his mobile vibrate in his pocket and pulled it out. But for a few seconds, the din was such that he couldn't immediately hear Robin.
"Found her! Say that again!"
he shouted, as the train rumbled away.
"We've found her! Inside the ottoman, inside the sitting room. Concrete was poured in all around her, but we can see a bit of her skull and maybe a femur."
"Shit!" Strike had expected the presence of the body in the Athorn's flat, but there was nothing routine, ever, about finding a dead human.
"Concrete,"
he repeated.
"Yes, it doesn't look that well mixed, amateurish, but it's done the job. It probably killed most of the smell.
Hell of a weight on a supporting beam."
"Well, exactly. Where are you?"
"Outside, about to go in."
"Right. Call 999, then call Leybourne and tell him where I am and why. That should speed things up."
"Okay.
Good luck."
Strike hung up. The nondescript street of terraced houses was quiet now the train had gone, birdsong replacing its thunderous clamour. Strike, who'd been waiting where he couldn't be seen, now walked up the street, passing three small houses, and at the fourth turned left up a short garden path, then beat a tattoo on the dark red front door. The net curtains twitched, and Janice Beattie's cross face appeared. Strike raised a hand in greeting. The curtain fell. After a slightly longer wait than might have been expected, given the short distance from sitting room to hall, Janice opened the door. She was dressed all in black today, with sheepskin carpet slippers on her feet. Her clear china-blue eyes, rimmed in steel, looked as kind and innocent as ever. Silver-haired, apple-cheeked, she frowned up at the detective, but didn't speak.
"Can I come in?" asked Strike.
There was a long pause. The wild birds tweeted, and Strike thought fleetingly of the budgies in the Athorn's flat, where part of his mind was dwelling on the image of a skull and a femur poking up through concrete.
"If you must," said Janice slowly.
He followed Janice into the red sitting room, with its cheap crimson Turkish rug, its dried flower pictures, and its faded photographs. The sun was making the spun-glass Cinderella carriage and its six horses twinkle on top of the fire, which Janice had on, in spite of the mildness of the September day.
"Want a cup of tea?" said Janice.
"That'd be great," said Strike, fully alive to the unreality of the situation.
He listened to her sheepskin muffled footsteps receding and the sound of the kitchen door opening. Taking out his mobile phone, he switched it to record and laid it on the arm of the chair in which he'd sat last time. He then pulled on a pair of latex gloves and followed Janice quietly out of the room, the worn carpet muffling his footsteps. At the door, he paused, listening to the soft bubbling of boiling water against a kettle lid and the tinkle of teaspoons and the opening of a cupboard. With one fingertip, he pushed open the kitchen door. Janice spun round, eyes wide. On seeing him, she grabbed one of the china mugs on the tray and raised it hurriedly to her lips, but Strike had already taken a stride towards her. Gripping the thin wrist with his latex-gloved hand, forcing the mug away from her mouth, he felt bone beneath the soft flesh and the papery skin of the elderly. With his free hand, he pulled the mug out of hers and examined it. A good inch of viscous white liquid was swimming in the bottom of it. Still holding Janice's wrist, he looked into the teapot, which contained more of the same, then opened the cupboard over the kettle. It was jammed with bottles of pills, weed killer, bleach, and jam jars full of what looked like home-dried plants, leaves, and fungus. A poisonous storehouse, a testimony to a lifetime's careful study of the means by which death could be delivered in the guise of healing.
"Think I'll skip tea," said Strike. "Let's have a chat, shall we?"
She offered no resistance as he led her by the wrist back through to the sitting room and pushed her down onto the sofa.
"A murder-suicide would be a hell of a way to go out," said Strike, standing over her. "But I don't much fancy being victim number... How many is it?"
Janice said nothing. Her round blue eyes registered only shock. Strike looked up at the wall of old photographs. One showed a toothy, beaming brunette bride, her hair worn in ringlets, in a high-necked lace dress, a pillbox hat on top of her veil, a large mole on her left cheekbone. Just above it was a picture of a young blonde with her hair worn in a frizzy 80s perm. She was wearing a red coat. He hadn't noticed, hadn't seen, because he'd walked into the room with certain expectations, making assumptions no less sweeping than Talbot had, with his conviction that Cancerians were intuitive, gentle, and perceptive. Nurses were angels ministering to the vulnerable. He'd been as guilty of bias as Vi Cooper, seeing Janice through the prism of his grateful memories of the nurses in Selly Oak, who'd helped him manage pain and depression, and of Carenza down in Cornwall, bringing comfort and kindness every single day. And on top of it all, he'd been fooled by a veritable genius for lies and misdirection.
"I thought," said Strike, "I should come and tell the Athorn social worker in person that a body's been found in their flat." "You do a very good middle-class accent, Janice. I suppose the phone Claire uses is around here somewhere."
He looked around.
Possibly she'd hidden it when she'd seen who was at the door.
He suddenly spotted the hairdryer, tucked away behind the sofa, but with its lead protruding. He sidled past the coffee table, bent down, and pulled it out, along with a roll of cellophane, a small phial with the label pulled off, a syringe, and some chocolates.
"Leave 'em,"
said Janice, suddenly and angrily, but he laid the items on the coffee table instead.
"How ill would I have been if I'd eaten one of those dates you were doctoring when I arrived last time?" he asked. "You used the hairdryer to fix the cellophane back round them, right?"
When she didn't answer, he said,
"I haven't thanked you for those chocolates you sent Robin and me at Christmas. I had flu. Only managed to eat a couple before puking my guts up. Chucked the rest away because they had bad associations. Lucky for me, eh?"
Strike now sat down in the armchair beside his mobile, which was still recording.
"Did you kill all these people?"
Strike asked, gesturing up at the wall of photographs.
"Or do some of them just have recurrent bowel problems around you?" "No," he said, scrutinizing the wall. "Irene's not up there, is she?"
She blinked at him through the lenses of her round silver glasses, which were far cleaner than Dennis Creed's. A car came trundling up the road beyond the net curtains. Janice watched it pass, and Strike thought she was half expecting to see a police car. Perhaps she wasn't going to talk at all. Sometimes people didn't. They preferred to leave it all up to the lawyers.
"I spoke to your son on the phone last night," said Strike.
"You never!"
The words had burst out of her, in shock.
"I did," said Strike. "Kevin was quite surprised to hear you'd been visiting him in Dubai, because he hasn't seen you in nearly 7 years. Why'd you pretend you're visiting him? To get a break from Irene?"
She pressed her lips together. One hand was playing with the worn wedding ring on the other.
"Kevin told me he's had barely any contact with you since leaving home. You weren't ever close," he said. "But he paid for you to fly out there 7 years ago, because he thought he should give you another chance, as he put it. And his young daughter managed to ingest quite a lot of bleach while you were looking after her. She survived, just. And since then, he's cut you off completely." "We ended up talking for nearly 2 hours," said Strike, watching Janice's colour fluctuate. It was hard for Kevin to say out loud what he suspected all these years. Who wants to believe their own mum's been poisoning people? He preferred to think he was paranoid about all those special drinks you used to give him. "And apparently your first husband..."
"He wasn't my husband," muttered Janice. "We were never married."
"Left because he thought you were doing things to his meals, too. Kevin used to think his father was making it all up. But after our chat last night, I think he's seeing things very differently. He's ready to come over and testify against you."
Janice gave a small convulsive jerk. For almost a minute, there was silence.
"You're recording this,"
she whispered at last, looking at the mobile lying on the arm of Strike's chair.
"I am, yeah," said Strike.
"If you turn that off, I'll talk to you."
"I'll still be able to testify to whatever you tell me."
"I'm sure a lawyer would tell me not to let myself be recorded, though."
"Yeah," Strike acknowledged. "You're probably right."
He picked up the mobile, turned it to face her so she could watch, switched off the recording, then laid it down on the small coffee table beside the chocolates, the empty file, the syringe, the cellophane, and the hairdryer.
"Why do you do it, Janice?"
She was still stroking the underside of her wedding ring.
"I don't know why," she said. "I just like it."
Her eyes wandered over the wall of photographs.
"I like seeing what happens to them if they take poison or too many drugs. Sometimes I like helping them and having them be grateful. And sometimes I like watching them suffer. And sometimes I like watching them go."
A prickle ran up the back of Strike's neck.
"I don't know why," she said again. "I sometimes think it's because I had a bang on the head when I was 10. My dad knocked me downstairs. I was out for 15 minutes. Ever since then I've had headaches. Head trauma can do things to you, you know. So maybe it's not my fault, but I don't know." "With me granddaughter," said Janice, frowning slightly. "I just wanted her gone, honestly. Spoiled and whiny. I don't like kids," she said,
looking directly back at Strike.
"I've never liked kids. I never wanted them. Never wanted Kev. But I thought if I had it, his dad might marry me. But he never. He wouldn't. It was having a baby what killed my mum," said Janice. "I was 8. She had it at home. Placenta previa, it was. Blood everywhere. Me trying to help, no doctor, my father drunk, screaming at everyone. I took this,"
said Janice quietly, showing Strike the wedding ring on her finger.
"Off mum's dead hand. I knew my father would sell it for drink. I took it and hid it so he couldn't get it. It's all I got of her. I love my mum,"
said Janice Beattie, stroking the wedding ring. And Strike wondered whether it was true, whether head trauma and early abuse had made Janice what she was, and whether Janice had the capacity to love at all.
"Is that really your little sister, Claire?"
Strike asked, pointing at the double frame beside Janice, where the sleepy-eyed, overweight man with smoker's teeth faced the heavy but pretty blonde.
"No,"
said Janice, looking at the picture. After a short pause, she said,
"She was Larry's mistress. I killed both of them. I'm not sorry. They deserved it. He was with me. He wasn't much of a catch, but he was with me. The pair of them carrying on behind my back. Bitch,"
said Janet quietly, looking at the picture of the plump blonde.
"I assume you kept the obituaries."
She got slowly up from the sofa, and Strike heard her knees click as she walked towards the china cabinet in the corner, which housed most of her cheap spun glass ornaments, and knelt down, again steadying herself with one hand on the mantelpiece. But now, instead of one folder, she tugged two out of the drawer in the base of the cabinet, and Strike remembered how she'd shifted things around in the drawer last time, doubtless removing those things she didn't want him to see.
"That one," she said, showing him the fatter of the two folders, "is all the stuff about Margot. I cut out everything I could find. Needed a second folder for all her clippings."
She opened the thinner folder, which was the one Strike had seen before, and extracted an old work newsletter headed Hickson and Co. The blonde's colour photograph featured prominently at the top.
"Claire Martin," said Janice. "Every drinker she was. Accidental overdose. Liver failure. I knew she was taking too many paracetamol for her endometriosis. I watched her doing it. Me and Larry had a bunch of people over to the house. They thought I was stupid. Eye contact between them all night long. Thick as mince, the pair of them. I was mixing drinks. Every cocktail I gave her was half liquid paracetamol. She died 8 days later. And there's Larry's,"
she said indifferently, holding up a second newsletter from Hickson and Co.
"I waited 6-7 months. That was easy. He was a walking time bomb, Larry. The doctors had warned him his heart was wrecked. Pseudoephedrine, that was. They never even checked him for drugs in his system. They knew what it was. Smoking and eating like a pig. Nobody looked further than his dodgy ticker."
Strike detected not the slightest sign of remorse as she shuffled the obituaries of her victims as though they were so many knitting patterns. Her fingers trembled, but Strike thought that was down to shock, not shame. Mere minutes ago she'd thought of suicide. Perhaps that cool and clever brain was working very hard beneath the apparently frank surface, and Strike suddenly reached out and removed the drugged chocolates from the table beside Janice and put them down on the floor beside his chair. Her eyes followed them, and he was sure he'd been right to suspect she was thinking of eating them. Now he leaned forwards again and picked up the old yellow clipping he'd examined last time, showing little Johnny Marks from Bethnal Green.
"He was your first, wasn't he?"
Janice took a deep breath and exhaled. A couple of the cuttings fluttered.
"Yeah," she said heavily. "Pesticide. You could get all sorts in them days, buy it over the counter. Organophosphates. I fancied him something rotten, Johnny Marks. But he made fun of me. Yeah, so they thought it was peritonitis and he died. It's true the doctor didn't turn up, mind. People didn't care when it was kids from a slum. That was a bad death he had. I was allowed to go in and look at him after he died. I give him a little kiss on the cheek," said Janice. "He couldn't stop me then, could he? Shouldn't have made fun of me."
"Marks," said Strike, examining the clipping, "gave you the idea for Spencer, right? It was the name that first connected her with you. But I should have twigged when Claire phoned me back so promptly. Social workers never do that. Too overworked."
"Huh,"
said Janice, and she almost smiled.
"Yeah, that's where I got the name.
Claire Martin and Johnny Marks.
You didn't keep Brenner's obituary, did you?
No,
said Janice. Because you didn't kill him?
No. He died of old age somewhere in Devon. I never even read his obituary. But I had to come up with something, didn't I, when you asked for it? So I said Oakden took it.
She was probably the most accomplished liar Strike had ever met. Her ability to come up with falsehoods at a moment's notice, and the way she interwove her plausible lies with truth, never attempting too much, and delivering everything with such an air of authenticity and honesty, placed her in a class apart.
Was Brenner really addicted to barbiturates?
No, said Janice.
She was shuffling the obituaries back into their folder now, and Strike spotted the clipping about Holy Basil, on the reverse of which was Joanna Hammond's death notice.
No,
she repeated, as she put the obituaries back into her bottom drawer and closed it, as though it mattered any more whether she tidied these things away, as though they wouldn't soon be used in evidence against her. Knees clicking, she got slowly to her feet again and returned to the sofa.
I was getting Brenner to sign for drugs for me, she said. He thought I was selling them on the street, dopey old sod.
How did you persuade him to overorder drugs? Blackmail?
Suppose you'd call it that, yeah, she said. I found out he was going to see a prostitute locally. One of her kids told me Brenner was visiting her once a week. I thought, right, I'll get you, you dirty old bastard. He was coming up for retirement. I knew he didn't want to end his career in disgrace. I went in to see him one day in his consulting room and told him I knew. He nearly had a heart attack, said Janice, with a malicious smile. I told him I knew how to keep me mouth shut, and then I asked him to get me some drugs. He signed like a lamb. I was using stuff Brenner got me for years after.
The prostitute was Betty Fuller, right?
Yeah, said Janice. I thought you'd find that out.
Did Brenner really assault Deborah Athorn?
No. He checked her stitches after she had sewn, that's all.
Why did Clara Spencer tell me that story? Just blowing a bit more smoke around?
Janice shrugged.
I dunno. I thought maybe you'd think Brenner was a sex pest and Margot found out he was fiddling with patients.
Was there ever really an Amitol capsule in Brenner's mug?
No, said Janice. It was in Irene's mug. That was stupid, she said,
her pink and white brow furrowed. The wide blue eyes drifted over her wall of victims' photographs, to the window and back to Strike.
I shouldn't have done that. Sometimes I sailed a bit close to the wind. Took silly risks. Irene was pissing me off one day on reception, flirting with... Just flirting, said Janice. So I took her a mug of tea with a couple of capsules in it. She talks till you could throttle her. I just wanted her to shut the hell up for a bit. But she let it go cold. I was sort of glad after I'd calmed down. I got the mug and took it out the back to wash up. But Margot come creeping up behind me in her flat shoes. I tried to hide it, but she saw. I thought she'd go telling tales, so I had to get in first. I went straight to Dr. Gupta and said I found a capsule in Dr. Brenner's tea and told him I thought he was over-ordering drugs and was addicted. What else could I do? Gupta was a nice man, but he was a coward. Bit scared of Brenner. I thought he probably wouldn't confront him, and he didn't. But honestly, I knew even if he had, Brenner would rather pretend to be an addict than risk me telling anyone about his dirty little thing with Betty Fuller.
And was Margot really worried about how Dorothy Ogden's mother died?
No, said Janice again. But I had to tell you something, didn't I?
You're a genius of misdirection, said Strike,
and Janice turned slightly pink.
I've always been clever, she mumbled. But that don't help a woman. It's better to be pretty. You have a better life if you're good-looking. Men always went for Irene, not me. She talked shit all night long, but they liked her better. I wasn't bad-looking. I just didn't have what men liked.
When we first met, the two of you, said Strike, ignoring this, I thought Irene might have wanted you interviewed together to make sure you didn't spill her secrets. But it was the other way round, wasn't it? You wanted to be there to control what she said.
Yeah, well, said Janice with another sigh. I didn't do that well, did I? She was blabbing left, right and centre.
Tell me, did Charlie Ramage really see a missing woman in Leamington Spa?
No. I just needed to give you something to think about instead of Margot prodding Kev in the tummy. Charlie Ramage told me he saw Mary Flanagan in a country churchyard in Worcestershire somewhere, I think it was. I knew nobody could say no different. I knew he was dead, and I knew he talked such bollocks. Nobody around him would remember one more tall story.
Was the mention of Leamington Spa supposed to nudge me towards Irene and Satchwell?
Yeah,
said Janice. Did you put drugs in Wilma Bayliss's thermos? Is that why she seemed drunk to people at the surgery?
I did, yeah.
Why?
I already told you, said Janice restlessly. I don't know why I do it. I just do. I wanted to see what would happen to her. I like knowing why things are happening when nobody else does. How did you work all this out? She demanded. Talbot and Lawson never suspected.
Lawson might not have done, said Strike, but I think Talbot did.
He never, said Janice at once. I had him eaten out of me hand.
I'm not so sure, said Strike. He left a strange set of notes, and all through them he kept circling back to the death of Scorpio, or Juno, which are the names he gave Joanna Hammond. 7 interviews, Janice. I think he subconsciously knew there was something off about you. He mentions poison a lot, which I think had stuck in his mind because of the way Joanna died. At one point, I was reading the notes again last night, he copies out a long description of the tarot card, the Queen of Cups, words to the effect that she reflects the observer back at themselves. To see the truth of her is almost impossible. And on the night they hauled him off to hospital, he hallucinated a female demon with a cup in her hand and a 7 hanging round her neck. He was too ill to string his suspicions together, but his subconscious kept trying to tell him you weren't all you seemed. At one point he wrote, "Is Cetus right?" He called Irene Cetus. And eventually, I asked myself what she could have been right about. Then I remember that the first time we met the pair of you, she told us she thought you were sweet on Douthwaite. At the sound of Douthwaite's name, Janice winced slightly. Oakden said you got giggly around Douthwaite too, Strike continued, watching her closely. And Dorothy bracketed you with Irene and Gloria as some kind of scarlet woman, which implies you'd done some flirting in front of her.
Is that all you went on? Me flirting once and being the Queen of Cups? Said Janice, managing to get a note of scorn into her voice, though he thought she seemed shaken.
No, said Strike. There were plenty of other things. Strange anomalies and coincidences. People kept telling me Margot didn't like the nurse. But they got you confused with Irene a lot, so it took me a while to twig that they really did mean you. Then there was Fragile X. When I saw you that first time with Irene, you claimed you'd only been to visit the Athorns once. But the second time I met you, you seemed to know a hell of a lot about them. Fragile X was called Martin Bell syndrome back in the early 70s. If you'd only seen them that one time, it seemed odd you knew exactly what was wrong with them, and used the modern term. And then I started noticing how many people were getting stomach upsets or acting drugged.
Did you put something in the punch at Margot and Roy's barbecue?
I did, yeah, she said. Ipecac syrup, that was. I thought it would be funny if they all thought they got food poisoning from the barbecue. But then Carl broke the bowl, and I was glad, really. I just wanted to see them all ill, and maybe look after them all, and ruin our party. But it was stupid, wasn't it? That's what I mean. I sailed close to the wind sometimes. They were doctors. What if they'd known? It was only Gloria who had a big glassful and was sick. Margot's husband didn't like that. Ruined their smart house.
And Strike saw the almost indiscriminate desire for disruption that lay behind the meek exterior.
Gloria throwing up at the barbecue, said Strike. Irene and her irritable bowel syndrome. Kevin and his constant stomach aches. Wilma swaying on her feet and vomiting while she was working at St. John's. Me, puking up my Christmas chocolates. And, of course, Steve Douthwaite and his vision problems, his headaches and his churning guts. I'm assuming it was Douthwaite Irene was flirting with, the day you put Amital capsules in her tea.
Janice pressed her lips together, eyes narrowed.
I suppose you told her he was gay to try and get her to back off.
She already had Eddie gagging to marry her, Janice burst out. She had all these blokes down the pub flirting with her. If I told her how much I liked Steve, she'd have taken him for the fun of it. That's what she was. So, yeah, I told her he was queer.
What are you drugging her with these days?
It varies, said Janice quietly. Depends how much she's pissing me off.
So, tell me about Steve Douthwaite.
Suddenly, Janice was breathing deeply. Her face was flushed again. She looked emotional.
He was such a beautiful man.
The passionate throb in her voice took Stryker back, almost more than the full stock of poisons she was keeping in her kitchen. He thought of the cheeky chap in his kipper tie who'd become the puffy, bloodshot-eyed proprietor of the Allardyce in Skegness, with his strands of greying hair stuck to his sweating forehead, and not for the first time, Strike had reason to reflect on the extraordinarily unpredictable nature of human love.
"I've always been one to fall head over heels," said Janice.
And Strike thought of Johnny Marks dying in agony, and Janice kissing him farewell on his cold, dead cheek.
"Oh, Steve can make you laugh. I love a man what can make you laugh. Really handsome. I used to walk past his flat 10 times a day just to get an hello. We got friendly. He started dropping in, telling me all his problems. And he tells me how he's mad about this married woman, fallen for his mate's wife. On and on and on about how hard her life is, and there's me sitting there with a kid on me own. What about my hard life? She had an husband, didn't she? But no. I could tell I wasn't going to get nowhere with him unless she was out the way. So I thought, right, well, she'll have to go. She was no better looking than I was, muttered Janice, pointing at the picture of Joanna Hammond on the wall. State of that thing on her face. So I looked her up in the phone book, and I just went round her house when I knew her husband was at work. I used to have this wig I wore to parties. Put that on, and me uniform, and a pair of glasses I used to have. But I didn't need. Rang the doorbell, told her I'd had a tip-off about her domestic situation. People will always let a nurse in, said Janice. She was desperate to talk to someone. I got her good and emotional, crying and all that. She told me about sleeping with Steve, and how she thought she was in love with him. I made her a drink with latex gloves on. Half of it was weed killer. She knew, the moment she tasted it. But I grabbed her hair from behind.
Janice mimed the motion in midair.
Pulled her head back, forced it down her fucking throat. Oh, yeah. Once she was on the floor, choking, I poured some more down. Neat. Had to stay a while, to make sure she didn't try and phone anyone.
Once I knew she was too far gone to recover, I took off my uniform and left. It takes nerve, said Janice Beattie, her colour high and her eyes bright. But act normal and people don't see nothing strange. You just got to hold your nerve. And maybe I wasn't showy looking when I was young, but that helped. I wasn't the kind people remembered. Next day, near enough, I had Steve crying his eyes out round my place. It was all going great, said the woman who poured neat weed killer down her rival's throat. I saw him loads after that. He was round my place all the time. There was something there between us. I could feel it. I never drugged him a lot, said Janice, as though this was true evidence of affection. Only enough to stop him going out. Make him feel he needed me. I used to look after him really well. Once he slept on my sofa, and I wiped his face for him while he was asleep, she said. And again, Strike thought of the kiss she'd given the dead Johnny Marks. But sometimes, said Janice with bitterness, men thought I was the mumsy type and didn't see me as anything else. I could tell Steve liked me, but I thought he might not be seeing me the right way, you know, with being a nurse and Kev always dragging round after me. One evening, Steve come over and Kev was having a tantrum and Steve said he thought he'd be off. Let me look after Kev. And I could tell, I thought, you're not going to want me with a kid. So I thought, Kev needs to go.
She said it as though talking about taking out the bins.
But you got to be careful when it's your own kid, said Janice. I needed to get an history going. He couldn't just die, not after being perfectly healthy. I started experimenting with stuff. I was thinking, maybe a salt overdose. Claim he did it on a dare or something. I started putting stuff in his food here and there. Get him complaining to teachers about stomach aches and that. And then I'd say, oh, I know, I think it's a bit of schoolitis.
But then Margot examined him, said Strike.
But then, repeated Janice slowly, nodding, that hoity-toity bitch takes him into her surgery and examines him. And I knew she was suspicious. She asked me after what drinks it was I'd given him, because the little bastard had told her mummy was giving him special drinks. Not a week later, said Janice, twisting the old wedding ring on her finger, I realised Steve's going to see her about his health instead of coming to see me. Next thing I know, Margot's asking me all about Joanna's death, out the back by the kettle, and Dorothy and Gloria were listening in. I said, how the hell should I know what happened? But I was worried. I thought, what's Steve been telling her? Has he said he thinks there was something wrong with it? Has someone said they saw a nurse leaving the house? I was getting worried. I sent her chocolates full of phenobarbital. Irene had told me Margot had had threatening notes, and I'm not surprised, interfering bitch she was. I thought, they'll think it's whoever sent them notes, sent the chocolates. But she never ate them. She threw them in the bin in front of me. But after, I heard she'd taken them out the bin and kept them. And that's when I knew. I really knew. I thought, she's going to get them tested.
And that's when you finally agreed to go on a date with simple old Larry, said Strike.
Who says he was simple?
Said Janice, firing up. Irene, said Strike. You needed access to concrete, didn't you? Didn't want to be seen buying it, I'd imagine. What did you do? Tell Larry to take some and not mention it to anyone? She simply looked at him out of those round blue eyes that nobody who hadn't heard this conversation could possibly mistrust. What gave you the idea of concrete? Strike asked. That rumour of the body in the foundations?
Yeah, said Janice finally. It seemed like the way to stop the body smelling. I needed her to disappear. It was too near home, what with her examining Kev and asking me about Joanna, and keeping those chocolates.